Commander endured the rest of the ride in silence, wishing the medicines he was taking allowed him to eat. No, to retain what he ate. 15 minutes later, Gon parked his jeep 50 meters from the shop and led his commander to the building by an indirect route. By this time, Kati was thoroughly confused and more than a little angry. When the lights went on, he saw the bomb case.
So, what about it? Come here.
Gon led him to the corner. The engineer bent down and lifted the toolbox.
Behold.
What is it? It looked like a small cannonball, a sphere of metal. Gon was enjoying this. Kati was angry, but that would soon change.
It's plutonium.
The commander's head snapped around as though driven by a steel spring.
What? What do...
Gon held up his hand. He spoke softly, but positively.
What I am sure of, Commander, is that this is the explosive portion of an atomic bomb. An Israeli atomic bomb.
Impossible,
the commander whispered.
Touch it,
Gon suggested. The commander bent down and touched a finger to it.
It's warm.
Why?
From the decay of alpha particles, a form of radiation that is not harmful. Here it is not, in any case. That is plutonium, the explosive element of an atomic bomb. It can be nothing else.
You're sure?
Positive. Absolutely positive. It can only be what I say it is.
Gon walked over to the bomb case.
These... He held up some tiny electronic parts. They look like glass spiders, no? They are called Krypton switches. They perform their function with total precision, and that kind of precision is necessary for only one application found inside a bomb case. These explosive blocks, the intact ones, note that some are hexagons, some are pentagons. That is necessary to make a perfect explosive sphere. A shaped charge, like that for an RPG, but the focus is inward. These explosive blocks are designed to crush that sphere to the size of a walnut.
But it's metal.
What you say is not possible.
Commander, I do not know as much as I should of these matters, but I do know a little. When the explosives go off, they compress that metal sphere as though it were made of rubber. It is... possible. You know what an RPG does to the metal on a tank, no? There is enough explosive here for 100 RPG projectiles. They will crush the metal as I say. When it is compressed, the proximity of the atoms begins a nuclear chain reaction. Think, Commander. The bomb fell into the old man's garden on the first day of the October War. The Israelis were frightened by the force of the Syrian attack, and they were immensely surprised by the effectiveness of the Russian rockets. The aircraft was shot down, and the bomb was lost. The exact circumstances don't matter. What matters, Ismail, is that we have the parts of a nuclear bomb.
Gon pulled out another cigarette and lit it.
Can you?
Possibly.
The engineer said. Kati's face was suddenly cleared of the pain he'd known for over a month.
Truly, Allah is beneficent. Truly he is. Commander, we need to think about this very carefully, very thoroughly. And security?
Kati nodded. Oh, yes. You did well to bring me here alone. For this matter, we can trust no one.
No one at all.
Kati let his voice trail off, then turned to his man.
What do you need to do? My first need is for information. Books, Commander.
And do you know where I must go to get them?
Russia?
Gon shook his head.
Israel, Commander. Where else?
Representative Alan Trent met with Ryan in a House hearing room.
It was the one used for closed-door hearings and was swept daily for bugs.
How's life treating you, Jack? The congressman asked.
No special complaints, Al. The president had a good day.
Indeed he did. The whole world did.
The country owes you a debt of thanks, Dr. Ryan.
Jack's smile dripped with irony.
Let's not allow anybody to learn that, okay?
Trent shrugged.
Rules of the game. You should be used to it by now.
So, what brings you down on such short notice?
We have a new operation going. It's called Nitaka. The DDCI explained on for several minutes. At a later date, he would have to hand over some documentation. All that was required now was notification of the operation and its purpose.
$1 million a month.
That's all he wants?
Trent laughed aloud.
The director was appalled, Jack reported. I've always liked Marcus, but he's a tight-fisted son of a bitch. We've got 2 certified Japan bashers on the oversight committee, Jack. It's going to be hard to rein them in with this stuff.
3, counting you, Al.
Trent looked very hurt.
Me?
A Japan basher? Just because there used to be 2 TV factories in my district, and a major auto parts supplier has laid off half its people? Why the hell should I be the least bit angry about that?
Let me see the cabinet minutes, the congressman commanded.
Ryan opened his case.
You can't copy them. You can't quote from them.
Look, Al, this is a long-term op, and...
Jack, I didn't just get into town from the chicken ranch, did I?
You've turned into a humorless SOB. What's the problem?
Long hours, Jack explained as he handed the papers over.
Al Trent was a speed reader and flicked through the pages with indecent speed. His face went into neutral, and he turned back into what he was before all things, a cold, calculating politician. He was well to the left side of the spectrum, but unlike most of his ilk, Trent let his ideology stop at the water's edge. He also saved his passion for the house floor and his bed at home. Elsewhere, he was icily analytical.
Fowler will go ballistic when he sees this. They are the most arrogant people.
You've sat in on cabinet meetings.
Ever hear stuff like this? Trent asked.
Only on political matters. I was surprised by the tone of the language, too, but it might just be a cultural thing, remember?
The congressman looked up briefly.
True.
Beneath the patina of good manners, they can be wild and crazy folks. Kind of like the Brits, but this is like Animal House.
Christ, Jack, this is explosive.
Who recruited him?
The usual mating dance. He shows up at various receptions, and Chief of Station Tokyo caught a whiff, let it simmer for a few weeks, then made his move. The Russian handed over the packet and his contractual demands.
Why Operation Nitaka, by the way?
I've heard that before somewhere, haven't I?
I picked it myself. When the Japanese strike force was heading for Pearl Harbor, the mission execute signal was, climb Mount Nitaka.
Remember, you're the only guy here who knows that word. We're going on to a monthly change identification cycle on this. This is hot enough that we're giving him the whole treatment.
Right, Trent agreed. What if this guy's an agent provocateur?
We've wondered about that. It's possible, but unlikely. For KGB to do that.
Well, it kind of breaks the rules as they are understood now, doesn't it?
Wait.
Trent read over the last page again.
What the hell's this about communications?
What it is scary.
Ryan explained what he wanted to do.
50 million.
You sure?
That's the one-time startup costs. Then there's the new communicators. Total annual costs after startup are about 15 million.
Pretty reasonable, actually.
Trent shook his head.
NSA is quoting a much higher price to switch over to their system.
They have a bigger infrastructure to worry about. That number I gave you ought to be solid. Mercury is pretty small.
How soon do you want it? Trent knew that Ryan quoted hard budget numbers. It came from his business experience, Al knew, which was pretty thin in government service. "Last week would be nice, sir." Trent nodded. "I'll see what I can do." "You want it black, of course." "Like a cloudy midnight," Ryan answered. "God damn it," Trent swore. "I've told Olson about this. His technical weenies do their rain dance, and he buys it every time. What if..." "Yeah. What if all our communications are compromised?" Jack did not make it a question. "Thank God for Glasnost, huh? Does Marcus understand the implications?" "I explained it to him this morning. He understands. Al, Cabot may not have all the experience you or I would like, but he's a fast learner. I've had worse bosses."
"You're too loyal."
"Must be a lingering symptom of your time in the Marines," Trent observed. "You'd be a good director." "Never happen." "True. Now that Liz Elliott is National Security Advisor, you'll have to cover your ass. You know that." "Yep." "What in hell did you do to piss her off? Not that it's all that hard to do." "It was back right after the convention," Ryan explained. "I was up in Chicago to brief Fowler. She caught me tired from a couple of long trips, and she yanked my chain pretty hard. I yanked back." "Learn to be nice to her," Trent suggested. "Admiral Greer said that." Trent handed the papers back to Ryan.
"It is difficult, isn't it?"
"Sure is. Learn anyway. Best advice I can give you."
"Probably a total waste of time, of course."
"Yes, sir. Good timing on the request, by the way. The rest of the committee will be impressed as hell with the new operation. The Japan bashers will put the word out to their friends on appropriations that the agency is really doing something useful. We'll have the money to you in 2 weeks if we're lucky." "What the hell? $50 million, chicken feed. Thanks for coming down." Ryan locked his case and stood. "Always a pleasure." Trent shook his hand.
"You're a good man, Ryan. What a damn shame you're straight."
Jack laughed. "We all have our handicaps, Al." Ryan returned to Langley to put the Nitaka documents back in secure storage, and that ended his work for the day. He and Clark took the elevator down to the garage and left the building an hour early, something they did every 2 weeks or so. 40 minutes later, they pulled into the parking lot of a 7-Eleven between Washington and Annapolis.
"Hello, Doc Ryan,"
Carol Zimmer said from behind the register. One of her sons relieved her there, and she led Jack into the back room. John Clark checked out the store. He wasn't worried about Ryan's security, but he had some lingering worries about the way some local toughs felt about the Zimmer enterprise. He and Chavez had taken care of that one gang leader, having done so in front of three of his minions, one of whom had tried to interfere. Chavez had shown mercy to that lad, who hadn't required an overnight stay at the local hospital. That, Clark judged, was a sign of Ding's growing maturity. "How is business?" Jack asked in the back room.
"We up 26% from this time last year."
Carol Zimmer had been born in Laos less than 40 years before, rescued from a hilltop fortress by an Air Force Special Operations helicopter, just as the North Vietnamese Army had overrun that last outpost of American power in northern Laos. She'd been 16 at the time, the last living child of a Hmong chieftain who'd served American interests and his own. He'd been a willing agent, courageously and well, and to the death. She'd married Air Force Sergeant Buck Zimmer, who'd died in yet another helicopter after yet another betrayal. And then Ryan had stepped in. He hadn't lost his business sense, despite his years of government service. He'd selected a good site for the store, and as fate had it, they hadn't needed his educational trust fund for the first of the kids now in college. With a kind word from Ryan to Father Tim Riley, the lad had a full scholarship at Georgetown and was already dean's listed in pre-med. Like most Asians, Carol had a reverence for learning that bordered on religious fanaticism, and which she passed on to all of her kids. She also ran her store with the mechanistic precision a Prussian sergeant expected of an infantry squad. Kathy Ryan could have performed a surgical procedure on a register counter. It was that clean. Jack smiled at the thought. Maybe Lawrence Alvin Zimmer Jr. would do just that. Ryan looked over the books. His CPA certificate had lapsed, but he could still read a balance sheet.
You eat dinner with us?
Carol, I can't. I have to get home. My son has a Little League game tonight. Everything's okay? No problems? Not even those punks?
They not come back. Mr. Clark scare them away for good.
If they ever come back, I want you to call me right away, Jack said seriously.
Okay, okay. I learn lesson, she promised him.
Fine. You take care. Ryan stood.
Doc Ryan?
Yes?
Air Force say Buck die in accident. I never ask anybody, but I ask you. Accident? No accident?
Carol, Buck lost his life doing his job, saving lives. I was there. So was Mr. Clark.
The ones make Buck die?
You have nothing to fear from them, Ryan said evenly. Nothing at all. Jack saw the recognition in her eyes. Though Carol had modest language skills, she'd caught what he'd meant by his answer.
Thank you, Doc Ryan. I never ask again, but I must know.
It's okay. He was surprised she'd waited so long. The bulkhead-mounted speaker rattled.
Con, sonar. I have a routine noise level bearing 047, designate contact Sierra 5. No further information at this time. We'll advise.
Very well. Captain Ricks turned to the plotting table. Tracking party, begin your TMA. The captain looked around the room. Instruments showed a speed of 7 knots, a depth of 400 feet, and a course of 303. The contact was broad on his starboard beam. The ensign commanding the tracking party immediately consulted the Hewlett-Packard mini-computer located in the starboard aftered corner of the attack center.
Okay, he announced. I have a trace angle. Little shaky. Computing now.
That took the machine all of 2 seconds.
Okay, I have a range gate. It's a convergence zone, range between 3-5 and 4-5,000 yards if he's in CZ-1, 5-5 and 6-1,000 yards for CZ-2.
It's almost too easy, the XO observed to the skipper.
You're right, X. Disable the computer, Ricks ordered.
Lieutenant Commander Wally Claggett, Executive Officer, Gold, USS Maine, walked back to the machine and switched it off.
We have a casualty to the HP computer. Looks like it'll take hours to fix, he announced.
Pity. Thanks a lot, Ensign Kenshaw observed quietly to the quartermaster hunched next to him at the chart table.
Be cool, Mr. Shaw, the petty officer whispered back. We'll take care of you. Don't need that thing now anyway, sir.
Let's keep it quiet in the attack center, Captain Ricks observed.
The submarine's course took her northwest. The sonar operators fed information to the attack center as she did so. 10 minutes later, the tracking party made its decision.
Captain, Ensign Shaw announced, estimate contact Sierra 5 is in the first CZ. Range looks like 39,000 yards, course is generally southerly, speed between 8 and 10 knots.
You can do better than that, the CO announced sharply.
Con, sonar, Sierra 5 looks like Akula-class Soviet fast attack. Preliminary target ident is Akula number 6, the Admiral Lunin. Stand by.
A moment's silence.
Possible aspect change on Sierra 5, possible turn. Con, we have a definite aspect change. Sierra 5 is now beam on, definite beam aspect on target.
Captain, the XO said, that maximizes the effectiveness of his towed array.
Right. Sonar, Con, I want a self-noise check.
Sonar, aye. Stand by, sir.
Another few seconds.
Con, we're making some sort of noise. Not sure what. Rattle, like maybe something in the after ballast tanks. Didn't show before, sir. Definitely aft. Definitely metallic. Con, maneuvering room, we got something screwy back here. I can hear something from aft, maybe in the ballast tanks. Captain, Shaw said next. Sierra 5 is now on a reciprocal heading. Target course is now southeasterly, roughly 130. Maybe he can hear us, Ricks growled. I'm taking us up through the layer. Make your depth 100 feet. 100 feet, aye, the diving officer responded immediately. Helm, 5 degrees up on the Fairwater Plains. 5 degrees up on the Fairwater Plains, aye. Sir, the Fairwater Plains are up 5 degrees, coming to 100 feet. Con, maneuvering, the rattle has stopped. It stopped when we took the slide-up angle. The XO grunted next to the captain. What the hell does that mean? It probably means that some dumbass dockyard worker left his toolbox in the ballast tank. That happened to a friend of mine once. Ricks was truly angry now, but if you had to have such incidents, here was the place for them. When we get above the layer, I want to go north and clear datum. Sir, I'd wait. We know where the CZ is. Let him slide out of it. Then we can maneuver clear while he can't hear us. Let him think he's got us scoped before we start playing tricks. He probably thinks we don't have him. By maneuvering radically, we're tipping our hand. Ricks considered that. No. We've canceled the noise aft. We've probably dropped off his scopes already. And when we get above the layer, we can get lost in the surface noise and maneuver clear. His sonar isn't all that good. He doesn't even know what we are yet. He's just sniffing for something. This way we can put more distance between us. Aye, aye, the XO responded neutrally. Main leveled off at 100 feet, well above the thermocline layer, the boundary between relatively warm surface water and the cold deep water. It changed acoustical conditions drastically and, Ricks judged, should eliminate any chance that the Akula had him. Con, sonar, contact lost on Sierra 5. Very well. I have the con, Ricks announced. Captain has the con, the officer of the deck acknowledged. Left 10 degrees rudder, come to new course 350. Left 10 degrees rudder, aye, coming to new course 350. Sir, my rudder is left 10 degrees. Very well. Engine room, con. Make turns for 10 knots. Engine room, aye, turns for 10 knots, building up slowly. Main steadied up on a northerly course and increased speed. It took several minutes for her towed array sonar to straighten out and be useful again. During this time, the American submarine was somewhat blinded. Con, maneuvering, we got that noise again, the speaker announced. Slow to 5. All ahead 1/3. All ahead 1/3, aye. Sir, engine room answers all ahead 1/3. Very well. Maneuvering, con. What about that noise? Still there, sir. We'll give it a minute, Ricks judged. Sonar, con. Got anything on Sierra 5? Negative, sir. Holding no contacts at this time. Ricks sipped at his coffee and watched the clock on the bulkhead for 3 minutes. Maneuvering, con. What about the noise? Has not changed, sir. It's still there. Damn. X, bring her down a knot. Claggett did as he was told. The skipper was losing it, he realized. Not good. Another 10 minutes passed. The worrisome noise aft attenuated, but did not go away. Con, sonar. Contact bearing 015. Just appeared real sudden-like. It's Sierra 5, sir. Definite Akula class. Admiral Lunan. Evaluate as direct path contact, bow on aspect. Probably just came up through the layer, sir. Does he have us? Ricks asked. Probably yes, sir, the sonar man reported. Stop, another voice announced. Commodore Mancuso walked into the room. Okay, we conclude the exercise at this point. Will the officers please come with me? Everyone let out a collective breath as the lights went up. The room was set in a large square building shaped not at all like a submarine, though its various other rooms duplicated most of the important parts of an Ohio-class boomer.
Mancuso led the attack center crew into a conference room and closed the door.
Bad tactical move, Captain. Bart Mancuso was not known for his diplomacy.
XO, what advice was that you gave to your skipper?
Claggett recited it word for word.
Captain, why did you reject that advice?
Sir, I estimated that our acoustical advantage was sufficient to allow me to do that in such a way as to maximize separation from the target.
Wally?
Mancuso turned to the skipper of the red team, Commander Wally Chambers, about to become the CO of USS Key West. Chambers had worked for Mancuso on Dallas and had the makings of one hell of a fast attack skipper. He had just proven that, in fact.
It was too predictable, Captain.
Moreover, by continuing course and changing depth course, you presented the noise source to my towed array, and also gave me a hull-popping transient that ID'd you as a definite submarine contact. You would have been better off to turn bow on, maintain depth, and slow down. All I had was a vague indication. If you'd slowed down, I would never have ID'd you. Since you didn't, I noted your hop on top the layer and sprinted in fast underneath as soon as I cleared the CZ. Captain, I didn't know I had you until you let me know, but you let me know, and you did let me get close. I floated my tail over the layer while I stayed right underneath it. There was a fairly good surface duct, and I had you at 29,000 yards. I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me. Then it was just a matter of continuing my sprint until I was close enough for a high-probability solution. I had you cold. The point of the exercise was to show you what happened when you lost your acoustical advantage. Mancuso let that sink in before going on. Okay. So it wasn't fair, was it? Whoever said life was fair?
Akula's a good boat. But how good is its sonar?
We assume it's as good as a second flight 688.
No way, Ricks thought to himself.
What other surprises can I expect?
Good question. The answer is that we don't know.
And if you don't know, you assume they're as good as you are.
No way, Ricks told himself.
Maybe even better, Mancuso didn't add.
Okay, the Commodore told the assembled attack center crew. Go over your own data, and we do the wash-up in 30 minutes.
Ricks watched Captain Mancuso exit the room, sharing a chuckle with Chambers. Mancuso was a smart, effective sub-driver, but he was still a damned fast-attack jockey who didn't belong in command of a boomer squadron because he simply didn't think the right way. Calling in his former shipmate from Atlantic Fleet, another fast-attack jockey. Well, yeah, that's how it was done, but damn it, Ricks was sure he'd done the right thing. It had been an unrealistic test. Ricks was sure of that. Hadn't Roselli told the both of them that Maine was quiet as a black hole? Damn. This was his first chance to show the Commodore what he could do, and he'd been faked out of making a favorable impression by an artificial and unfair test and some goofs from his people, the ones Roselli had been so damned proud of.
Mr. Shaw, let's see your TMA records.
Here, sir. Ensign Shaw, who'd graduated sub-school at Groton less than 2 months before, was standing in the corner, the chart and his notes grasped tightly in his tense hands. Ricks snatched them away and spread them on a work table. The captain's eyes scanned the pages.
Sloppy. You could have done this at least a minute faster.
Yes, sir, Shaw replied. He didn't know how he might have gone faster, but the captain said so, and the captain was always right.
That could have made the difference, Ricks told him, a muted but still nasty edge on his voice.
Sorry, sir.
That was Ensign Shaw's first real mistake. Ricks straightened, but still had to look up to meet Shaw's eyes. That didn't help his disposition either.
Sorry doesn't cut it, mister. Sorry endangers our ship and our mission. Sorry gets people killed. Sorry is what an unsatisfactory officer says. Do you understand me, Mr. Shaw?
Yes, sir.
Fine. The word came out as a curse. Let's make sure this never happens again. The rest of the half hour was spent going over the records of the exercise. The officers left the room for a larger one, where they would relive the exercise, learning what the red team had seen and done. Lieutenant Commander Claggett slowed the captain down.
Skipper, you were a little hard on Shaw.
What do you mean? Ricks asked in annoyed surprise.
He didn't make any mistakes. I couldn't have done the track more than 30 seconds faster myself. The quartermaster I had with him has been doing TMAs for 5 years. He's taught it at subschool. I kept an eye on both of them. They did okay.
Are you saying the mistake was my fault? Ricks asked in a deceptively gentle voice.
Yes, sir, the XO replied honestly, as he had been taught to do.
Is that a fact?
Ricks walked out the door without another word.
To say that Petra Hassler-Bach was unhappy was an understatement of epic proportions. A woman in her late 30s, she'd lived over 15 years on the run, hiding from the West German police before things had simply become too dangerous, precipitating her escape to the East Zone. What had been the East Zone, the Bundeskriminalamt investigator smiled to himself. Amazingly, she'd thrived on it. Every photo in the thick file showed an attractive, vital, smiling woman with a girl's unlined face framed by pretty brown hair. This same face had coldly watched 3 people die, one after several days of knife work, the detective told himself. That murder had been part of an important political statement. It had been at the time of the vote on whether or not to allow the Americans to base their Pershing II and cruise missiles in Germany, and the Red Army faction had wanted to terrify people into seeing things their way. It hadn't worked, of course, though it had made the victim's death into a gothic exercise.
Tell me, Petra, did you enjoy killing Wilhelm Manstein? The detective asked.
He was a pig, she answered defiantly. An overweight, sweaty, whoremongering pig.
That was how they'd caught him, the detective knew. Petra had set up the kidnapping first by attracting his attention, then by establishing a brief but fiery relationship. Manstein had not been the most attractive example of German manhood, of course, but Petra's idea of women's liberation was rather more robust than the norm in Western countries. The nastiest members of Bader-Meinhof and the RAF had been the women. Perhaps it was a reaction to the Kinderkuche-Kirche mindset of German males, as some psychologists said, but the woman before him was the most coldly frightening assassin he'd ever met. The first body parts mailed to Manstein's family had been those which had offended her so greatly. Manstein had lived for 10 days after that, the pathologist's report stated, providing noisy red entertainment for this still young lady.
Well, you took care of that, didn't you? I imagine Gunther was somewhat unsettled by your passion, wasn't he? After all, you spent, what, 5 nights with Herr Manstein before the kidnapping? Did you enjoy that part also, mein Schatz?
The insult scored, the detective saw. Petra had been attractive once, but no longer. Like a flower a day after cutting, she was no longer a living thing. Her skin was sallow, her eyes surrounded by dark rings, and she'd lost at least 8 kilos. Defiance blazed out from her, but only briefly.
I expect you did, giving in to him, letting him do his thing. You must have enjoyed it enough that he kept coming back. It wasn't just baiting him, was it? It could not have been just an act. Herr Manstein was a discerning philanderer. He had so much experience, and he only frequented the most skillful whores. Tell me, Petra, how did you acquire so much skill? Did you practice beforehand with Gunther? Or with others? All in the name of revolutionary justice, of course. Or revolutionary kameradschaft, nicht wahr? You are a worthless slut, Petra. Even whores have morals, but not you. And your beloved revolutionary cause, the detective sneered.
Doch. Such a cause.
How does it feel to be rejected by the entire German Volk?
She stirred in her chair at that, but couldn't quite bring herself.
What's the matter, Petra? No heroic words now? You always talked about your visions of freedom and democracy, didn't you? Are you disappointed now that we have real democracy? And the people detest you and your kind? Tell me, Petra, what is it like to be rejected? Totally rejected.
And you know it's true, the investigator added.
You know it's no joke. You watched the people in the street from your windows, didn't you? You and Gunther. One of the demonstrations was right under your apartment, wasn't it? What did you think while you watched, Petra? What did you and Gunther say to each other? Did you say it was a counter-revolutionary trick?
The detective shook his head, leaning forward to stare into those empty, lifeless eyes, enjoying his own work, as she had done.
Tell me, Petra, how do you explain the votes? Those were free elections. You know that, of course. Everything you stood for and worked for and murdered for, all a mistake, all for nothing.
Well, it wasn't a total loss, was it? At least you got to make love to Wilhelm Manstein.
The detective leaned back and lit a small cigar. He blew smoke up at the ceiling.
And now, Petra? I hoped you enjoyed that little tryst, mein Schatz. You will never leave this prison alive.
Never, Petra. No one will ever feel pity for you, not even when you're confined to a wheelchair.
Oh, no. They'll remember your crimes and tell themselves to leave you here with all the other vicious beasts. There is no hope for you. You will die in this building, Petra.
Petra Hassler-Bock's head jerked at that. Her eyes went wide for an instant as she thought to say something, but stopped short. The detective went on conversationally.
We lost track of Gunther, by the way. We nearly got him in Bulgaria, missed him by 30 hours. The Russians, you see, have been giving us their files on you and your friends. All those months you spent at those training camps. Well, in any case, Gunther is still on the run. In Lebanon, we think, probably hold up with your old friends in that rat pack.
They're next, the detective told her. The Americans, the Russians, the Israelis, they're cooperating now, didn't you hear?
It's part of this treaty business. Isn't that wonderful? I think we'll get Gunther there. With luck, he'll fight back or do something really foolish, and we can bring you a picture of his body. Pictures, that's right. I almost forgot. I have something to show you, the investigator announced.
He inserted a video cassette into a player and switched on the TV. It took a moment for the picture to settle down into what was plainly an amateur video taken with a handheld camera. It showed twin girls, dressed in matching pink dirndl outfits, sitting side by side on a typical rug in a typical German apartment. Everything was fully in Ordnung. Even the magazines on the table were squared off. Then, the action started.
Komm, Erika. Komm, Ursel,
a woman's voice urged, and both infants pulled themselves up on a coffee table and tottered toward her. The camera followed their halting, unstable steps into the woman's arms.
Mutti, Mutti,
they both said. The detective switched the TV off.
They're talking und walking. Ist das nicht wunderbar? Their new mother loves them very much, Petra. Well, I thought you'd like to see that. That's all for today.
The detective pressed a hidden button and a guard appeared to take the manacled prisoner back to her cell. The cell was stark, a cubicle made of white painted bricks. There was no outside window,
and the door was of solid steel except for a spy hole and a slot for food trays. Petra didn't know about the TV camera that looked through what seemed to be yet another brick near the ceiling, but was really a small plastic panel transparent to red and infrared light. Petra Hassler-Bock retained her composure all the way to the cell, and until the door was slammed shut behind her. Then she started coming apart. Petra's hollow eyes stared at the floor. That was painted white also, too wide and horrified for tears at first, contemplating the nightmare that her life had become. It could not be real, a part of her said with confidence that bordered on madness. All she'd believed in, all she'd worked for, gone. Gunther, gone. The twins, gone. The cause, gone. Her life, gone. The Bundeskriminalamt detectives interrogated her only for amusement. She knew that much. They had never seriously probed her for information. But there was a reason for that. She had nothing worthwhile to give them. They'd shown her copies of the files from Stasi headquarters. Nearly everything her erstwhile fraternal socialist brothers had had on her, far more than she had expected, was now in West German hands. Names, addresses, phone numbers, records dating back more than 20 years, things about herself that she'd forgotten, things about Gunther that she'd never known, all in the hands of the BKA. It was all over. All lost. Petra gagged and started weeping. Even Erica and Ursel, her twins, the product of her own body, the physical evidence of her faith in the future, of her love for Gunther, taking their first steps in the apartment of strangers, calling some stranger Mutti, Mommy, the wife of a BKA captain. They'd told her that much. Petra wept for half an hour, not making noise, knowing that there had to be a microphone in the cell, this cursed white box that denied her sleep. Everything lost. Life. Here? The first and only time she'd been in the exercise yard with other prisoners, they'd had to pull two of them off of her. She could remember their screams as the guards had taken her for medical treatment. Whore, murderous, animal. To live here for 40 years or more, alone, always alone, waiting to go mad, waiting for her body to weaken and decay. For her life meant life. Of that she was certain. There would be no pity for her. The detective had made that clear. No pity at all. No friends. Lost and forgotten. Except for the hate. She made her decision calmly. In the manner of prisoners all over the world, she'd found a way of getting a piece of metal with an edge on it. It was, in fact, a segment of razor blade from the instrument with which she was allowed to shave her legs once a month. She removed it from its place of hiding, then pulled the sheet, also white, from the mattress. It was like any other, about 10 centimeters thick, covered with heavy striped fabric. Its trim was a loop of fabric in which was inserted a rope-like stiffener, with the mattress fabric sewn tight around it to give the edge strength. With the razor edge, she began detaching the trim from the mattress. It took 3 hours and not a small amount of blood, for the razor segment was small, and it cut her fingers many times, but finally she had 2 full meters of improvised rope. She turned one end of the rope into a noose. The free end of the rope she tied over the light fixture over the door. She had to stand on her chair to do that, but she'd have to stand on the chair in any case. It took 3 attempts to get the knot right. She didn't want too much length on the rope. When she was satisfied with that, she proceeded without pause. Petra Hassler-Bock removed her dress and her bra. Next, she knelt on the chair with her back to the door, getting its position and hers just right, placed the noose around her neck, and drew it tight. Then she drew up her legs, using her bra to secure them between her back and the door. She didn't want to flinch from this. She had to show her courage, her devotion. Without stopping for a prayer or lament, her hands pushed the chair away. Her body fell perhaps 5 centimeters before the improvised rope stopped her fall and drew tight. Her body rebelled against her will at this point. Her drawn-up legs fought against the bra holding them between the backs of her thighs and the metal door, but in fighting the restraint, they merely pushed Petra fractionally away from the door, and that increased the strangulation on her upper neck. She was surprised by the pain. The noose fractured her larynx before sliding over it to a point under her jaw. Her eyes opened wide, staring at the white bricks of the far wall. That's when the panic hit her. Ideology has its limits. She couldn't die. Didn't want to die. Didn't want to. Her fingers raced to her throat. It was a mistake. They fought to get under the mattress trim, but it was too thin, cutting so deeply into the soft flesh of her neck that she couldn't get a single finger under it. Still she fought, knowing that she had mere seconds before the blood loss to her brain. It was getting vague now. Her vision was beginning to suffer. She couldn't see the lines of mortar between the even German-made brickwork on the far wall. Her hands kept trying, cutting into the surface blood vessels of her throat, drawing blood that only made the noose slick, able to sink in tighter, cutting off circulation through the carotid arteries even more. Her mouth opened wide, and she tried to scream. No, she didn't want to die, didn't. Needed help. Couldn't anyone hear her? Could no one help her? Too late. Just 2 seconds. Maybe only one. Maybe not even that. The last remaining shred of consciousness told her that if she could just loosen the bra holding her legs, she could have stood and... The detective watched the TV picture, saw her hands flutter toward the bra, searching limply for the clasp before they fell away, and twitched for a few more seconds, then stopped. So close, he thought. So very close to saving herself. It was a pity. She'd been a pretty girl, but she'd chosen to murder and torture, and she'd also chosen to die. And if she'd changed her mind at the end, didn't they all? Well, not quite all. That was merely renewed proof that the brutal ones were cowards after all. Nicht wahr? Aber natürlich. This television is broken, he said, switching it off. Better get a new one to keep an eye on prisoner Hasslerbach. That will take about an hour, the guard supervisor said. That's fast enough. The detective removed the cassette from the same tape recorder he'd used to show the touching family scene. It went into his briefcase with the other. He locked the case and stood. There was no smile on his face, but there was a look of satisfaction. It wasn't his fault that the Bundestag and Bundesrat were unable to pass a simple and effective death penalty statute. That was because of the Nazis, of course. Damned barbarians. But even barbarians were not total fools. They hadn't ripped up the Autobahns after the war, had they? Of course not. So just because the Nazis had executed people, well, some of them had even been ordinary murderers whom any civilized government of the era would have executed. And if anyone merited death, Petra Hasslerbach did. Murder by torture. Death by hanging. That, the detective figured, was fair enough. The Wilhelm Manstein murder case had been his from the start. He'd been there when the man's genitals had arrived by mail. He'd watched the pathologists examine the body, had attended the funeral, and he remembered the sleepless nights when he'd been unable to wash the horrid spectacles from his mind. Perhaps now he would. Justice had been slow, but it had come. With luck, those 2 cute little girls would grow into proper citizens, and no one would ever know who and what their birth mother had once been. The detective walked out of the prison toward his car. He didn't want to be near the prison when her body was discovered. Case
closed.
Hey, man. Marvin. I hear that you did well with weapons, Gon said to his friend. No big deal, man. I've been shooting since I was a kid. That's how you get dinner where I come from. You outshot our best instructor, the engineer pointed out. Your targets are a hell of a lot bigger than a rabbit, and they don't move. Hell, I used to hit jacks on the move with my .22. If you have to shoot what you eat, you learn right quick to hit what you aim at, boy. How'd you do with that bomb thing? Marvin Russell asked. A lot of work, for very little return, Gon replied. Maybe you can make a radio from all that electrical stuff, the American suggested. Perhaps something useful. Chapter 10 Last Stands. Flying west is always easier than flying east. The human body adjusts more easily to a longer day than a shorter one, and the combination of good food and good wine makes it all the easier. Air Force One had a sizable conference room that could be used for all manner of functions. In this case, it was a dinner for senior administration officials and selected members of the press pool. The food, as usual, was superb. Air Force One may be the only aircraft in the world which serves something other than TV dinners. Its stewards shop daily for fresh foods, which are most often prepared at 600 knots at 8 miles altitude, and more than one of the cooks had left military service to become executive chef at a country club or posh restaurant. Having cooked for the President of the United States of America looks good on any chef's resume. The wine in this case was from New York, a particularly good blush Chablis that the President was known to like when he wasn't drinking beer. The converted 747 had 3 full cases stowed below. 2 white-coated sergeants kept all the glasses filled as the courses came in and out. The atmosphere was relaxed, and the conversations all off the record, on deep background, and be careful or you'll never eat in here again. So, Mr. President, the New York Times asked, how quickly do you think this will be implemented? It is starting even as we speak. The Swiss Army representatives are already in Jerusalem to look things over. Secretary Bunker is meeting with the Israeli government to facilitate the arrival of American forces into the region. We expect to have things actually moving inside of 2 weeks. And the people who will have to vacate their homes? The Chicago Tribune continued the question. They will be seriously inconvenienced, but with our help the new homes will be constructed very rapidly. The Israelis have asked for and will get credits with which to purchase prefabricated housing made in America. We're also paying to set up a factory of that type for them to continue on their own. Many thousands of people will be relocated. That will be somewhat painful, but we're going to make it just as easy as we can. At the same time, Liz Elliott put in, let's not forget that quality of life is more than having a roof over your head. Peace has a price, but it also has benefits. Those people will know real security for the first time in their lives. Excuse me, Mr. President, the Tribune reporter said with a raised glass. That was not meant as criticism. I think we all agree that this treaty is a godsend. Heads nodded all around the table. The way it is implemented is an important story, however, and our readers want to know about it. The relocations will be the hardest part, Fowler responded calmly. We must salute the Israeli government for agreeing to it, and we must do the best we can to make the process just as painless as is humanly possible. And what American units will be sent over to defend Israel? Another reporter asked. Glad you asked, Fowler said. He was. The previous questioner had overlooked the most obvious potential obstacle to treaty implementation. Would the Israeli Knesset ratify the agreements? As you may have heard, we are reestablishing a new army unit, the 10th United States Cavalry Regiment. It's being formed at Fort Stewart, Georgia, and at my direction, ships of the National Defense Reserve Fleet are being mobilized right now to get them over to Israel just as quickly as we can.
The 10th Cavalry is a famous unit with a distinguished history. It was one of the black units that the Westerns have almost totally ignored. As luck would have it, luck had nothing to do with it. The first commander will be an African-American, Colonel Marion Diggs, a distinguished soldier, West Point grad and all that. That's the land force. The air component will be a complete wing of F-16 fighter bombers, plus a detachment of AWACS aircraft and the usual support personnel. Finally, the Israelis are giving us home porting at Haifa, and we'll almost always have a carrier battle group and a marine expeditionary unit in the Eastern Med to back up everything else. But with the drawdown, Dennis Bunker came up with the idea on the 10th Cavalry, and frankly, I wish I could say that it's one of mine. As for the rest, well, we'll try to fit it in somehow or other with the rest of the defense budget.
Is it really necessary, Mr. President? I mean, with all the budget battles, particularly on the matter of defense, do we really have to?
Of course we do. The National Security Advisor cut the reporter off at his ugly knees. You asshole, Elliot's expression said. Israel has serious and very real security considerations, and our commitment to preserving Israeli security is the sine qua non of this agreement.
Christ, Marty. Another reporter muttered.
We'll compensate for the additional expense in other areas, the president said. I know I'm returning to one more round of ideologically based wrangling over how we pay for the cost of government, but I think we have demonstrated here that government's costs do pay off. If we have to nudge taxes up a little to preserve world peace, then the American people will understand and support it, Fowler concluded matter-of-factly. Every reporter took note of that. The president was going to propose yet another tax increase. There had already been peace dividend 1 and 2. This would be the first peace tax, one of them thought with a wry smile. That would sail through Congress along with everything else. The smile had another cause as well. She noted the look in the president's eyes when he gazed over at his national security advisor. She'd wondered about that. She'd tried to get Liz Elliott at home twice, right before the trip to Rome, and both times all she'd gotten on her private line was the answering machine. She could have followed up on that. She could have staked out Elliott's townhouse off Kalorama Road and made a record of how often Elliott was sleeping at home and how often she was not. But that was none of her business, was it? It wasn't. The president was a single man, a widower, and his personal life had no public import so long as he was discreet about it, and so long as it didn't interfere with his conduct of official business. The reporter figured she was the only one who'd noticed. What the hell, she thought, if the president and his national security advisor were that close. Maybe it was a good thing. Look how well the Vatican Treaty had gone. Brigadier General Abraham Ben-Yakob read over the treaty text in the privacy of his office. He was not a man who often had difficulty in defining his thoughts. That was a luxury accorded him by paranoia, he knew. For all of his adult life, a life that had started at age 16 in his case, the first time he'd carried arms for his country, the world had been an exceedingly simple place to understand. There were Israelis, and there were others. Most of the others were enemies or political enemies. A very few of the others were associates or perhaps friends, but friendship for Israel was mostly a unilateral business. Avi had run 5 operations in America against the Americans. Against was a relative term, of course. He'd never intended harm to come to America. He'd merely wanted to know some things the American government knew, or to obtain something the American government had and Israel needed. The information would never be used against America, of course, nor would the military hardware. But the Americans, understandably, didn't like having their secrets taken away. That did not trouble General Ben-Yakob in any way. His mission in life was to protect the state of Israel, not to be pleasant to people. The Americans understood that. The Americans occasionally shared intelligence information with the Mossad. Most often this was done on a very informal basis.
and on rare occasions the Mossad gave information to the Americans. It was all very civilized. In fact, it was not at all unlike two competing businesses who shared both adversaries and markets, and sometimes cooperated, but never quite trusted each other.